Let's go ahead and get started. Big news is we have an exam here Thursday. I do a lecture time. I will have a Q&A session today at 5 in Bausch & Lomb 106. You can ask anything you want then. And other than that, anybody have any questions about the exam? Any issues? Now, I want to apologize ahead of time. I'm going to use prepared slides today, so because I hurt my thumb and it's a little awkward to write. So, that said, I know that may make me go faster, so if you need me to, so let me know. Okay? Alright, so we have started talking about optics, and you heard that you can use Maxwell's equations to extract the basic laws of geometrical optics. And so the way in which rays of light are bent through thin lenses, the way in which prisms work, etc., can come straight out of Maxwell's equations. Once you say that light is a wave, it turns out there are a lot of other things that basically come with that. So you guys did waves in 113, right? Did you do standing waves and that kind of thing? Music?
We kind of skipped waves.
What?
We kind of skipped waves last
semester. You kind of skipped waves.
We had a guest lecture. That's what happened.
Oh, okay. Well,
we know nothing about waves.
You might want to go back and read that chapter. So what I'm hoping you learned about waves is that waves exhibit interference and diffraction and refraction and stuff. So it is the fact that electromagnetic waves are waves is what made this sort of refraction happen at the glass surface. But other things that will happen are known as interference and diffraction. And so I want to spend time talking to you about those things. Interference, you really sort of know about intuitively. It happens all the time. If you're at the ocean, you ever noticed if you have a little wave coming this way, you know, it'll bob you up like that. You have a little wave coming this way, it'll bob you up like that. If you have them coming at the same time, you bob a lot higher because when they come together, they add together, right? If you have the trough of one hitting at the same time as a wave is coming in where it's peaked, it sort of cancels out, and you end up not bobbing at all, if you can think of it that way. It turns out that's a very fundamental characteristic of waves. And what it says is that the amplitude that you experience is the sum of the input of all the different waves. They basically just add together. And we call that particular phenomenon interference. You can think of it as the vector superposition of the fields. If we want to think about electromagnetic fields, for example, we know that if I have an electric field with a magnitude of a certain value going this way and I have an electric field with a certain value going that way, they'll largely cancel out. If I have them both going this way, they add together. That's what happens with vectors, okay? So, because electromagnetic waves are made of vectors, they'll add together, exhibit this very thing. So, interference, you can sort of think of, imagine that I have an orange wave and a black wave where they're each described by their electric field components. So imagine the polarization direction is up and down this line and the electric field component is like so. And I have two different waves that are in the same space. Okay, let's say that they're in phase for simplicity. Then I could write the electric field for one of the waves like so. So this is a wave that's traveling in the Positive is the direction. Thinking. How do you know? You've got the thinking minus KZ. Minus means it's going in the positive Z direction. If that's a plus, it's going in the negative Z direction. Okay. So here's a wave that's going in the positive Z direction. It has the amplitude E0, 1. And you can, let's imagine it's the black one and it's just traveling along. Then we have a second wave that we'll say is in phase. So this phase angle I'll just set as 0. Let's call it the orange one, all right? It's in phase, which is why it looks like the same sine curve. But I'll allow it to have a different amplitude. They add together if they're in the same space. I mean, they're in phase like this. And if you take these two and you add them together, you'll get some wave that's like this blue thing. So if you were measuring the electric field in space as this wave goes through, you wouldn't measure this and you wouldn't measure that. You'd measure the sum of it. And that we call constructive interference when the two of them sum and give you something bigger than what you started with. So that would be the equivalent of two wave crests hitting you at the same time, and you go up twice as high. They were both the same height. You can have it happen the different way, which is if they're out of phase, by that meaning that when the peak of one is hitting you, the trough of the other is hitting you. If they're exactly out of phase, then these two hit at the same time. In this case, I could put a phase angle here of 180 degrees. And if I did that, then we'd get this kind of situation. And now when you add them together, you're not adding the amplitudes, you're adding the actual values, whatever they are. So this one is positive and high, this one's orange and negative, but a little smaller than that one. So you're left with this as the residual. So these two largely cancel out. If they had the same amplitude and they were exactly out of phase like this, you'd get nothing. They'd completely cancel. And so we call that destructive interference. Okay? And if you did this demo, you'll understand. If you didn't, maybe I'll try to pull it out next class. But if you have waves on a string, they're waves, and they exhibit interference just like this. And one demo that's really nice to do is if you have waves traveling on a string, when they hit a boundary, they're reflected, and when they're reflected, their phase flips 180 degrees. Okay, so it comes in like this, and when it's reflected, it's like that as it goes away. And light will exhibit the same sort of thing as we'll see later in this class. But what happens is you have a wave coming this way and a wave coming that way that has its phase flipped, so they basically have to interfere. And what you find is that as they travel through each other, sometimes they interfere and give you zero height to the string, and sometimes they interfere and give you twice the height to the string. So what this means is as they travel through, you get sort of this time-dependent pattern of sometimes nothing, sometimes big amplitude. And you'll find that you get that pattern frozen in space, and they're called standing waves. Did you see that? It's dramatically cool. I didn't see it. Wow. Okay. I'll have to get that one for you. So what happens is that you'll get patterns where the string vibrates like this, fixed in space, and you'll get other patterns where it vibrates like this, fixed in space, and another pattern where it vibrates like this, fixed in space. You didn't see that? So for a given length and a given frequency and a given mass of the string, these will happen at certain frequencies. All right. What that means is if I have a string and I tie it between two things and I pluck it, there are certain frequencies of vibration where you'll get good reflections and you'll get this kind of interference pattern. If you go at some other frequency, they won't add together cleanly and they'll just sort of wobble around and not do much. What that means is that for a string of a particular length, mass, and etc., there are certain frequencies where when you play them, they will play big and nice. Those are the resonances on the string. Those are the notes that the string plays, right? Because in sound, frequency corresponds to the pitch that you hear. You can change that frequency if you want to tighten the string. If you use a heavier string, you can change the temperature. That'll change the pitch of the sound that you hear. But it means that the string will only play certain discrete frequencies, which is why you have notes that are discrete in music. That phenomenon is really going to be exactly what gives you quantization in atoms and things. The minute you start saying matter and wave, it's exactly the same sort of phenomenon. So I view this as simply a quantization of sound in music. So it's very, very cool. At any rate, so with waves on strings, you will have all sorts of fabulous phenomenon because of interference and diffraction and things like that. Have you ever wondered, when you walked into Hoyt, for example, or many other auditoriums, why they have ugly crap like that on the walls? Did you ever wonder that? I always wondered that. It's like, if you're going to design auditoriums, you have to have a bad sense of aesthetics or something to sort of... The reason that stuff is there is because you notice the weird shapes. It takes the sound that's bouncing off that wall and sends it out in different directions. So that if you're sitting over here, you don't get a path of sound from my ears and a path of sound that bounces directly off of one spot over there and they cancel out, so you can't hear anything. So this kind of thing diffuses the sound and gives you lots of different surfaces where it bounces off of so that you don't have dead zones. Now, I've only really experienced a badly designed auditorium one time. And it was scary, actually. So I was in a meeting at Brookhaven National Lab with a bunch of collaborators working on an experiment there. And we were in the auditorium in the chemistry division at Brookhaven. So some of you may actually work there someday or have been there. At any rate, in this particular auditorium, I hope they fixed this by now, I walk into this meeting, and it's just a normal thing, a bunch of physicists sort of milling around. I sit down, and the guy who's leading the experiment stands up at the front and starts talking. And when he starts talking, I could hear a thing. And I sort of looked, and I, you know, it's like, he's talking. I'm not hearing anything. And I thought, holy shit, I just lost my hearing. I'm dead serious, okay? You know, it's one of those bone-chilling. I just scared the crap out of me. And I didn't know what to do. And I think I leaned forward, and it's half the guy, you know, it wasn't that. So I leaned a couple of rows where I said, can you hear him? And they're like, yeah, no problem. And I was just like, oh my God. And I can't remember exactly, but you know, within a few moments, I actually got up and I moved this far and I heard him perfectly. Here I couldn't hear him at all. Here I heard him perfectly. And it was an example of interference where there was a place where the voice sound from his voice interfered destructively with the sound that was bouncing off of some particular surface right back to me. And if I moved just a little bit, the path length of those two paths shifted a little bit, so the interference pattern changed, and I could hear it fine. So it was really bizarre. So at any rate, in spite of having to deal with the aesthetic ugliness of it, be thankful that auditoriums are sort of ugly. So one of the ways to examine this is through what we call double-slit interference. So I want to actually show you a couple of things using physical waves in water. So what I have is some water, which is on a glass, it's pretty thin, and then I have a switch I'm going to turn on some here. Now, I can't see that well. Basically, what I have is water, and then I have a long little paddle that sits just on the edge of the water, and it's tapping the edge of the water at a fixed frequency. And when it does that, it sends wave fronts out that are sort of plane waves, right? They're sort of long waves that are coming out. So you can sort of see that. Now, one thing is if I send those waves through a thin opening, notice that the straight waves coming in move out of that opening and they sort of move out in a spherical sort of sense. We're going to talk about what that causes that in a few minutes. That is known as diffraction. It's very important, so pay attention as we talk about it, because it is what limits the resolution for imaging systems. It's what you need if you want to look at something that is certain size. What determines what kind of instrument you can use, the electron microscope versus optical microscope, etc., is diffraction, typically. Now look what happens if I use two thin slits. Each of which basically acts sort of like a point source of waves. And you'll note that the waves now hit each other. And when they hit each other, if the waves go the same distance in the same time, they'll act together. If they go half wavelength different in half, they'll destructively interfere. So what you'll get is sort of regions which are a little brighter and a little darker, which are sort of lines along this way. Which I might be able to enhance by changing a few things here. So you sort of see the striations that are going this way a little bit as they add together. So this is really just an example of a physical wave interfering. And this is it's called two-slit interference because you basically have two sources. So if we look at the same thing, this since light is a wave, you'll have the same phenomenon happen. Let's suppose we have plane waves that are incident on basically a black wall with two thin parallel slits. And we're just looking at one plane perpendicular to that. And let's suppose these represent basically wave fronts not drawn very well. They're supposed to be all exactly the same, exactly parallel, and exactly the same distance apart. But let's suppose that these represent the distance between the points on the wave where the electric fields are straight up, okay, or straight up with highest amplitude. So these represent, this would be one wavelength separation. As this wave in such a pattern hits two thin slits, then diffraction, which we'll talk about in a minute, starts. But basically, the way you can think about it is at each of these slits, there are thin little of water, point sources of light, and you'll have light emitted from that point source with sort of a spherical looking wavefront coming out. Okay? And these two wavefronts will now hit each other. Nothing's changed the wavelength or the frequency here, and the speed of propagation is the same. So what will happen is if the wave from here and the wave from here hit each other having gone the same distance exactly, then they will be in the same phase at that point and they'll add together construct. If they've gone the same distance plus or minus a half integer number of wavelengths, then it will mean that one of them is out of phase with the other. That is, it's exactly down when the other is up, and they'll exactly cancel each other out. So we can actually understand this geometrically looking at such a picture. Let's say there's a distance d between the two slits. Okay? Then let's imagine that we project the light here onto these slits, which then you act as sources, and this light now interferes, and we look at it on a pattern, on a screen that's some distance away. The pattern on the screen that I draw here is meant to be intensity, that if I have this up high, it's very intense light, and if it's down low, it's very dim light, or you can't see it at all. So along this direction, it's sort of a measure of intensity. So it would be very intense here, dark line, intense, dark. And you'll get a pattern. The pattern is that every time the two waves are in phase, geometrically, you'll get an intense line. And every time they're out of phase, you'll get darkness. So let's think our way through that just a little bit. If we take the center point from the two slits all the way to the screen at 90 degrees here, then if I take light from this and light from this, they go the same distance. So that means they have to interfere constructively when they get to this point, which is why I have a bright fringe at that point. As I offset this angle, as I go down here, geometrically I'm pretending that I have this triangle that I basically just turn. And when I do, I open up this distance that's different in the path length for this ray versus that ray. Can you see that, what I'm trying to do? If I think of this triangle, if I imagine this point being right here, then I have this triangle like so, okay? And both arms are the same length. Now what I'm doing is I'm going down here, and when I do that, the whole triangle rotates like that, and that opens up a different path, a new piece of path here for this ray to go that ray doesn't have to follow. That means that this light on this path, having gone a little bit further, means that its phase might be different by the time it gets to this point than that path is. And it is that phase difference that determines whether you get a bright fringe or a dark fringe. So geometrically, if I choose this to be my angle, as this triangle opens up, that is approximately this angle as well. Stop me if you're not seeing this. You okay?
Can you go through it one more time?
Yeah. It may help if I try this. So if I have a ray of light coming here and a ray of light coming here, they have the same path length. They both have the same speed, so they'll both have oscillated exactly the same amount. They'll be in phase when they get to that end point. So that means you'll get a bright fringe right here. If I take this triangle, and I rotate it down this way, so that that very same triangle I had now looks like this. No, it's not bad. All I did was rotate it about this point. So that point stays fixed. So what that means is that the light from this point to the wall and from this point to the wall goes the same distance. The issue is, down at that angle, the light that is along this path not only goes this distance, but it has this additional little piece that it covers. And make sure I get the notation right. This little piece we call delta L. If that distance is an integral number of wavelengths, then I will have constructive paths, constructive interference. Because even though this ray has gone farther, all it's done is added a number of integral number of wavelengths, so it will come back to the same phase and add constructively. Okay? If this distance is an integral number of wavelengths plus or minus a half wavelength, then necessarily this ray is going to be exactly out of phase with the other ray. In which case, they add together destructively and I get a dark fringe. See some happy faces, some not happy, and some that are like, it's too hot in here, I want to be outside playing faces. Am I getting there? You got it? Yeah.
Okay, so when the angle, it goes down, that angle is the delta L. So
let's not worry about that angle yet.
No.
When I rotate this down and I leave this point fixed, I get this extra little path on. Okay? That extra little path length, if it's an integral number of wavelengths, then even though I've added the distance, the wave comes back to just what it is at this, say, the oscillation that it gets between here and there gets it right to the point where it's as the wave travels that different distance, it comes back to where it was because it's an integral number of wavelengths. So if when this triangle is up at this point, it adds together constructively, I will be back in that situation if this distance is the integral number of wavelengths. If I take this distance and I shift it by an integral number, if it's not an integral number, but an integral number plus or minus like a half of wavelengths, now, in traveling from here to here, this ray is now exactly opposite of what it was before, and it will interfere destructively with this other ray. That would all. It'll be the dark ray. So instead of looking bright, it'll be dark. So we can come back to this, but let me carry on a little bit and then see if it helps at all. So if I here's the triangle we were just talking about. Here is that distance, that extra distance that you have to have on one path because I'm now looking at some angle. If I have a distance d here, as I open up this angle with this triangle thing, I'm effectively opening up this angle as well. If you think of this as a cutout piece of plywood, if I rotate it about that point, as I rotate it down this angle opens up at the same time. So those angles are the same. I know a distance d, I have a distance delta l, here's a theta. So there's a relationship between delta L, so this opposite side over adjacent side, sorry, how do I have it? I have, this is meant to be right angles right here. So this is the hypotenuse. So delta L over D is equal to the sine of theta. That actually is an approximation that works fine if this distance is pretty big. So that means this distance, delta L, depends on the D here, the distance between the two fringes, and the angle that you choose. If this corresponds to a full wavelength, or an integral number of wavelengths, you get a bright fringe, and if it corresponds to an integral plus or minus a half wavelength, you'll get the dark fringes as you go down the angles. Small angles, sine theta and tangent theta, are basically the same. So this distance over d is, you can get the angle. But so what does that mean? Mathematically, what that says is, remember, we're looking at this distance delta L, this different distance. If that distance is an integral number of wavelengths. So if it's m lambda, where m is 0, 1, 2, on up, integral number of wavelengths, then the wave that Pat travels here has gone the same number of oscillations as it does if it's just here in the center. And so you'll have bright fringe on the screen, constructive interference. Delta L is d sine theta, so this formula, this is the distance between the two slits, this is the angle where you're looking at things relative to the center line, and this is the number of wavelengths. This formula then tells you where your bright fringes are on the screen. If I take this formula and I adjust this integral by half wavelength, then I'm going to get constructive interference. I'm sorry, thank you. Destructive interference. I have ways that you may not have imagined to lower the means on my exams. I say things the wrong way. So it's destructive interference if I have a half integral difference between the two paths. You okay with that?
Okay.
I'm going to say this again in a moment, but I understand if you've never seen this before, this may look a little awkward. You want to look at it again and again until you sort of clicks, because it's really not bad, but it is awkward to explain and awkward to see the first time. But go through and make it make sense. If you find yourself looking at this formula and saying, ooh, constructive interference, and this formula going destructive interference, automatically, you're in deep trouble. Because I can do little something like, oh, I can put a little material right here that slows this wave down a little bit, shifts its phase by half a wavelength. And if I did that, then this would be constructive and this would be destructive. Okay, so the simplest way to do this is not memorize the formulas, but actually know how they're derived, how they're extracted, and look at the specific problem and adjust accordingly. Okay, that's the difference between pattern recognition and actually understanding, and so that is what I try to do with this, right? So pay some attention to that. You definitely want to feel really comfortable with where these came from and how to get them. To the point that you don't really need to worry about having them on your formula sheet because you can just write it down, extracting it yourself. When you're at that point, then you're at the right point for thinking your way through a problem if I throw a little surprise to you. So that would be the classic example of what we call strictly interference between waves. And that's called the two-slit interference pattern. I promised you we'd talk a little bit more about diffraction, which if you recall when we looked at it on the wave front, we had a single opening, and the wave hit the single opening, and when it came out sort of going in a spherical sense. So where diffraction comes from is it is really just a manifestation of interference. But we think of it a little differently. When we talked about interference, we talked about the interference of waves between two separate sources. In diffraction, you sort of are talking about a single source, but you're talking about the interference of light from different portions of the same source. So the light that comes from this point of the slit and the light that comes from this point of the slit travels different distance when it gets to some point on the screen. Note that that's not true if you're looking at the center line. Everything here will sort of add together. If I have something here at the center and something on the edge, they will travel different distances. That is true. But pretty much for everything I have off to the side, I have a symmetric one over here that adds together. So what happens when you look at the so-called interference pattern or the intensity pattern on the screen when you have a single slit like this is that you'll get a big so-called interference or diffraction maximum right at the center of the slit, okay? And then you'll begin to have some minima off to the side, but the pattern looks rather different from what we just saw.
When you have the two slits, what you'll notice is that the bright fringes basically are evenly spaced. They have basically, at least out until some large angle, they have the same intensity. And you just have these fringes, okay?
For diffraction, you have a
rather different situation where you have a very intense central maximum
that's fairly broad, and then you'll have a minimum, and then you'll have less intense bright fringes as you go out. This gives you the position of the zeros of the fringes. And I'm not going to extract that one for you, which also means I will not be screwing around with those to make you have to figure out how it would change. So this one you can probably go a little bit more in pattern recognition mode. So what this says is that this minimum here, the angle is given by lambda over A. And I'm not going to derive that for you. But this is a characteristic diffraction pattern, it's called. It's fundamentally just interference, but it's just interference between waves thought of as point sources within the same source here. Notice something very important. If I have this wavelength over A, so this is the thickness of the object you're imaging, or the thickness of the slit, the width of the slit. If the wavelength over the slit is small, this angle is small. That is, the first bright fringe is over here. And basically it means the image of this slit
is not washed out. It's sharp. It makes this the diffraction maximum is very narrow. If this wavelength is on the order of A, or you know, if this is big on the scale of A, that is, if this slit is very small, as it gets comparable to the wavelength, then this angle gets big, which means this central maximum broadens out. I'm taking light, I'm shining it on a slit. If I take light and I shine it in a doorway, what's the image you see on the other side of the wall? Is out of the doorway, right? That's a sharp image. That works because the doorway is way big compared to the wavelength of the light. If I take that doorway and I make it smaller and smaller, you would expect the shadows on the other side, the bright thing, to just go close, just like I'm closing the door. But what I'm showing you here is when that doorway gets small enough that it starts to be comparable to the light wavelength, diffraction happens, and that central image is no longer really a clean image of the door. What you get is just this big diffraction mess on the wall. You get a fuzzed out, intense, bright fringe on the other wall. You lose your ability to image it. That's why it limits your ability to image things with microscopes and stuff. So this turns out to be really important. So what's happening here is that when A and lambda are comparable, this bright central diffraction maximum grows and washes out the actual optical image that you're used to seeing. It limits your ability to image anything. So what that means is you cannot use an optical instrument to image things that are on order of the size of a wavelength. If you want to image that, you have to go to something that has a much shorter wavelength, like electrons, when we get into quantum mechanics. So electron microscopes work precisely because you're imaging it with waves that are much smaller than the thing that you're trying to measure, which is why you can see things much smaller with electron microscopes. So I have a laser here, right? Just a plain laser, and I have it going through a very thin slit. So I don't know if you can see this back there, but what you should see is a very bright but broad central maximum, and then there are little dark fringes and much lighter, not as intense fringes as you go out either side. What I'm going to attempt to do is to narrow this a little bit, or widen it a little bit. When I narrow it, then this should get broader. When I go the other way, it should get narrower, and you'll begin to just see a bright dot there. So we'll see what happens when I try to do this. Okay, so I am opening it up now, and you should see, you see the pattern sort of, the fringes are going in, and the dot is becoming more pronounced. So what's happening is we're beginning to image the actual dot. The diffraction is becoming less and less. If I go the other way, so I'm now narrowing the slit, and if you can see it, the fringes are now moving outward, and the central maximum is growing in width. Are you seeing that at all? Can you see that from the back at all, or is it just a red line? It may depend on whether you need LASIK or not. Well, you don't want to get LASIK now. Save that for December. Much more fun. All right, so now I'm continuing to narrow it. Notice this broad minimum. I mean, it's now this big, if you can see the fringes at all. It's gotten from about here out to there. Because all I've done is narrow the slip, and that broadens that central maximum.
Okay. If you can see this, I have something that has two slits, and you actually can still see sort of a bright region here in the middle. That's because you're getting diffraction from each of the individual slits. So this would be a pattern similar to what we just had. But if you can see it, and I don't know how far up you can, there are thin black lines all the way through that central middle. Which with my supervision, I probably lose about right here. But sorry. If you want to see it after class, we'll mess around with it. You can see it. So what these thin slits are basically the double slit interference pattern. Okay. You have superimposed on that the diffraction pattern from the single slits, which sort of gives confines it to this one little area. Any questions on this talk? I know we're going sort of fast. Okay. There's another type of interference that's called thin film interference. And have you ever noticed that when the paparazzi are trying to take a picture of you or something, and you look at their lens as they point it at you, it looks sort of dark. Have you ever noticed that? Sort of looks dark, bluish, right? Or binoculars, if you've had somebody looking at your binoculars. I don't know where you're hanging out or what you're doing, but if you did, if you notice them, they're usually, they look dark. They're not reflective, okay? So there are a couple of reasons for that. One is certainly if you're a manufacturer of binoculars or rifle scopes or something like that, you really don't want people to see reflections off of the lenses because then they can figure out where you are. And if you're shooting at people, they can then shoot back, so it's not cool. If you're like an army sniper or on the SWAT team or something. SWAT team, SWAT. What are they called? SWAT. Squad, SWAT. The mysteries of life. So, the other thing is, oddly enough, if you make a surface anti-reflective, it means that you don't have some of that energy being reflected out. You have it going through the lens. So you're actually getting more energy into the lens. But what I'd like to do is to take you on a little tour of what's called thin film interference. Well, suppose that I have light coming in and hitting glass, and the light is coming in from the left. Imagine that I have, say, air over here, and then I have glass. So actually, I'm not doing an anti-reflective coating yet. We'll do that in a moment. Let's just suppose I have a plane of glass. So I have air, low end, call it one, low end air over here, and then I have a glass, a plane of glass
with distance d, and we'll say that the index of refraction is 1.5. Let's look at what happens, because you will get a reflection of light from both the front surface and the back surface of the light of the glass. And when those reflections, the ray that is bounces off the front side interferes with the ray that bounces from the back side, they recombine right there. So the question is, what do you actually see at that point? So there's a rule that you have to keep in mind. I mentioned a little while ago that if we have a wave on a string and I have a fixed end, that when the wave reflects, it has a 180-degree phase change. We have the same thing for waves which are light, except they're reflecting off of boundaries like this. So a way to think about it is, if the wave is going from a high end to a low end, then there's no phase change when it's reflected. So what that means is this wave, which is traveling in glass, when it reflects from high end to low end, you'll see no phase change. If you have a wave that is traveling from low end to high end, so from air and hits glass, and it's reflected off the glass, the front side of it, then you'll have a 180-degree phase change. So if we don't worry about this distance for the moment, and let's just assume, let's ignore that for a moment, then what we would have is light is reflected here, and it has a 180-degree phase change. It's reflected here with no phase change, and if we suppose this distance is effectively zero, then when they recombine, you have one with a phase change, one without, and you would get no reflection. You would have, it would look completely dark on the glass. Okay. The complication that you have here is that you have the phase changes, but in addition, this one ray has gone a distance of 2 times d in length. And as it travels, its phase is continually changing. So you have to take that into account. So those are the basic rules we have to think about. So what that means is that if you have this plane of glass, you know that the natural reflected waves are 180 degrees out of phase. So that means if 2 times d, this distance, is equal to an integer plus a half wavelength, then this ray that comes back will be back in phase, and you'll have a bright reflection. If it's an integral number of wavelengths, then because of these phase changes, you'll be 180 degrees out of phase when they combine, and you'll have a dark. This is... Okay, let me come back to this. So let me go for another moment. We'll talk more and think about this a little bit more. If you want to talk about anti-reflective coatings, then you do something like you have glass, and now you spread some crud on it, a coating that's often used as magnesium fluoride. And so the question is, how does this work? Let us suppose we consider a wavelength which is sort of in the center of the visible region, so green light. That's where your eye is most sensitive. So if you are going to aim to design an optical instrument so it does not reflect at a wavelength that people can identify and see, then you would choose this wavelength. Okay, so let's try that. And then the question is, how thick a coating do we make in order to minimize the reflection coming off of the lens? So here's how you think about it. We have air out here. Then we have a layer, we'll consider it uniform thickness, I might draw it quite that way, of magnesium fluoride, which has an index of refraction of 1.38. Then that is coated on glass that has an index of refraction of 1.5. Note that a ray of light coming in is reflected off of this boundary. It's also reflected off the boundary between the magnesium fluoride and the glass. In both of those boundaries, you're going from low end to high end, So there's a 180 degree phase change here and here. So your interfering rays, where in this case, because you're taking a coating and putting it on the glass, both of the rays that go back and interfere, both have been 180 degree phase change. So what that means is for us to have destructive interference. This is glass, this is the magnesium fluoride. You want this ray and this ray to interfere destructively at that point. They both get flipped by 180 degrees, so what that means is you want this distance, that is 2D, to be equal to an integral number plus a half of wavelengths. So you want this distance to be m plus a half lambda. And if you have that, then the two rays, when they recombine, are 180 degrees out of phase. So that's the formula that fits in this case. M can be 0, 1, 2, etc. So there are different thicknesses you can choose to get the same thing to happen. This makes sense? Again, note that this formula fits this particular problem very, very well. You really have to think your way through it, because it can be changed by changing the index of refraction of one of those substances so that you get 180 degree or not. So you have to think your way through whether you get phase flips at each reflection and the distance difference between the pads, both of which can contribute to whether or not you're getting destructive or constructive interference. So if you want to ask what is the thinnest possible film, then I now have turned it. So here is the air, this is the magnesium fluoride, and this is the glass. So you have this distance, extra path is 2 times this distance, this thickness. You have no phase change. There. But I was just wondering if this is something, I was talking about something else here. So you have 180 degrees here as well. So to get destructive interference, you want this distance 2D to be an integral number plus a half number of wavelengths. Okay? So that's this formula. If n is equal to 0, 2D is this, and that's corresponds to D equal to lambda over 4 times the index of refraction, or 100 nanometers. Yeah.
Why did you divide lambda by?
Because the wavelength you have to consider...
That's a fabulous question, and thank you for asking it, because I totally forgot to say it.
The wave is in air here, some reflects. That wave which travels through this and is reflected is inside the material. And inside the material, the wavelength is different. The wavelength is the wavelength in air divided by n. And it is that number of wavelengths that determines whether you're
destructive or not.
So the question was, this is lambda n. It's not just lambda. If I just wrote lambda, that would correspond to wavelength in vacuum or air. But what we're looking at is the path length difference, which is determined by this wave traveling through this material. And so it is that number of wavelengths that you're worrying about, whether it's integral or half integral. So if you choose n equals 0, then this equation goes to this. And this is the number of wavelengths in the material, and that's what brings in this n.
Can you explain the 2D is like why you chose 2D?
Because you're interfering some of the light that reflects off of this surface and some of the light that reflects off of this surface. And the difference between those two is that the light that reflects off this bottom surface has traveled an additional 2D. And in the time that it travels that additional 2D, its phase can change. So you have to take that into account. So if that 2D is an integral number of wavelengths or an integral plus or minus a half, that will determine when it recombines whether you have constructed.
So, again, let me just take a moment.
I understand it's hot, the weather's pretty, we're going fast. I totally get all that. This crap is way easier than Gauss's law, all right? So, even if it's not sticking now, gut this one out, spend some time on it, do some problems. Once we get through the exam on Thursday, I'll assign a wazoo load of problems. And this will come. It's really not bad at all compared to stuff you've already been through. It's just I'm shoving it all down your throat very fast because
that's what we're supposed to do this time of semester, I guess. It's a trade-off in this class. This class, I really do have to cover a lot of these things because they're very important for the kinds of reasons that you're taking the class and why it's a requirement.
Quite honestly, if it were up to me, your physics would be 3 semesters because that's the amount of material we're supposed to cover. The problem is when I teach this class, the trade-off is if I'm going to set it up so we can spend a little more time on the stuff we're doing now, then I'm compressing those days with Gauss's law and stuff, which I imagine most students I know agree went quite fast enough, thank you very much. I can't speed that up very much. So that's why this part of the class is a little bit painful. At any rate, the point I'm trying to make is I'm trying to step you through how to think about these things. Sometimes I get asked, why are you deriving this stuff? Give me the formula, whatever that I need. It is true, while sometimes I derive it just because it makes me feel good and it makes your life miserable, usually I have a real reason why. Okay? Sometimes more than others. Okay? In my mind, I derive things when that's the way I think about it, and I want you to learn how to think about it. And it's supposed to help it make sense. Sometimes your ability to derive it and understand it is actually critical to you ever being able to do any of the problems. And this is one of those times. You need to learn how to think your way through the two-slit interference and the thin film stuff in sort of the way that we've gone through it. Because it's really easy to tweak the problem a little bit, and what you thought was a constructive formula is a destructive formula. So if you don't think your way through it, you can't do these problems. So the derivation here isn't for fun. It's like the core way to do these problems. So please remember that. If you don't learn to do that, I would guess the final answer you get is going to be about 50%. You'll get right just because you're guessing. Okay. So on that happy note, if we go back to diffraction, what we have, we showed we have a two-slit interference pattern, and if we were to look at a single slit, we sort of get this pattern, and in reality, what we get with the double slit is a superposition of these two things, which in fact, if you were sitting far enough up, you saw a little while ago when I did the two slits with the laser, what you saw was a fairly bright region where you had a lot of thin, dark slits, and then you had off to the side, you had bigger, dark areas, and then some lighter areas that are not as bright as the central, but as fringes that continue. So that is in reality what you see. If I were to go to a more complicated slit pattern, that is, if I were going to give you multiple slits, you'll end up with a somewhat more complicated but not that different sort of pattern here, okay? And I'm not going to drag you through the details of what that kind of pattern looks like, but just know that if I put a bunch of slits here, I get sort of a similar thing. It turns out that making devices with lots of little slits is sort of hard.
So the way that people actually do it in reality is you take a smooth surface like glass, and you take something and you carve little thin ridges in it, very closely spaced.
And when you do that, you get a device which is called a diffraction ring. And the thing to note is if I have light coming from behind hitting multiple slits, it really looks the same if I have a device that's glass where I carve these little shapes in it, all uniformly spaced, and I have light coming in from the side and it reflects off it. It is as if I have a lot of single source slits that are the same distance apart. Okay? So, if I do this, and I take light and I shine it on this device, it will also give me intensity maxima, which fit this formula, which is one I'm not going to derive, so please feel free to think of this one as I memorize it sort of thing, okay? In this case, D is the distance between the gratings, the little ridges here. Sine theta is the angle relative to this diffraction grating where I see the light. This is M, in this case, is called the order. It's an integer number. And this is lambda. That is the wavelength of the light. So in this particular case, what I'm saying is, you know, it's complicated now because you have effectively an infinite number of slits. We're not going to derive it, but it fits this formula. That is, if I take light and I shine on this diffraction grating and I go out some angle, where I get bright fringes fits this formula. And I want you to notice that it depends on the wavelength. So if I have light that's made up of multiple wavelengths, the angle at which I get the maxima is different. And that's a very powerful thing because that enables me to spectrum analyze light. So we talked about a prism, and you can take a prism and do this too. I can take white light, put it through a prism, because we have this dispersion, that is, the refraction depends on the wavelength or the frequency of the light, it splits it into the rainbow. So you're all very familiar with that. Gratings do this much more powerfully. Through this formula, I get a separation that depends on what the distance is between these grating rulings, they call them rulings. I get an angle separation that depends on the wavelength. So in general, probably I hesitate to say all, but the vast majority of the optical instruments that you will use that do any sort of spectral analysis actually use gratings, not prisms. That's probably not all of them, but most of them. So if I'm going to separate wavelengths of light, what becomes important if I'm building an optical instrument is how well can I do that? That is, if I have two things that are very close together in wavelength, can I actually separate them?
Well, okay, so that's important for diffraction grating, and in fact, I'm not so much going to do resolution of that. I actually want to talk about
optical imaging resolution instead. So sorry. We talked a bit about how diffraction can be a problem optically. So what do I really mean by that? Let's suppose I have two point sources of light far away. Think of them as two stars
or think of it as possibly two parts to a cell or bacteria or something, okay? And you want to be able to take this light and image it as two different things. That's what you mean when you say you're imaging it reasonably, okay? So if I take this light, I basically have to send this light through an opening of some sort. Could be an opening to a telescope, opening of a microscope, eyepiece, whatever it is. If I do that, you can think of this as a point source of light and this is a point source of light. And as we've learned, if I have an opening with a diameter d, I will get a diffraction pattern from each of these points of light. And so, if the diffraction patterns are really wide, that is the central maxima are very, very big, then my ability to distinguish this as two different things is completely gone. The picture that comes here on the screen is just going to be a smeared out light, okay? As these things are further apart, or as this distance gets bigger relative to the wavelength, these central maxima become narrower. And so then the question is, at what point do you consider it to be possible to resolve these two point sources? That sort of defines your ability to resolve the things, and that tells you that that instrument is okay down to that level. And so the way that we consider it is this would be the limiting case. And notice what happened. I have one of the point sources gives me this red diffraction pattern. The other point source is so close that its diffraction pattern maximum, the purple one here, falls flat on the first minimum of that other diffraction pattern. You consider that to be the limit to your ability to resolve two things. If I take this and I put it into a quantitative expression, and it depends a little on the details of what the aperture is, but typically we have circular apertures like microscopes and telescopes and such. Then what you say is if I'm looking at two things that are separated by an angle, the sine of that angle is equal to 1.22 lambda over A is the limiting angle with which I can resolve two things. If the angle is any smaller, I couldn't resolve them. If it's any bigger, I don't have a problem resolving them. It depends on the wavelength, that depends on the opening. Sine theta for small angles, which this almost always would be, the angle is 1.22 lambda over this opening. And that then would be a formula that you could use to basically say, you know, I'm using this and such wavelength, here's my microscope with an opening of whatever, I can separate things to an angular resolution of a certain amount. That is, I can separate things where from my point of view, from the such and such a distance, the opening angle is so big. And this would be the limiting factor. It's known as Rayleigh's criterion.
And it is the limiting, it's what we call the limiting resolution for optical instruments. So I see I'm out of time. Let me think for a second. Okay, so what we're literally talking about is not only the instrument itself, but how big a wavelength do you need? Rayleigh's criterion can be used. So for example, if I'm shining light on a small object, you can think of this object as being your point source, your beam. If the wavelength is large compared to that, then the diffraction is big and Rayleigh's criterion kills you. If your wavelength is small compared to the size of the thing you're trying to image, then you can image it very well because Rayleigh's criterion is nice and satisfying. So this is an example of where the optical resolution comes into play for instruments. Okay. Go enjoy the day.